It is a delight to be here. Not necessarily to speak, but to be here is really neat. I was thinking about the camp out and how it brings back some wonderful memories of camp outs with people from many years ago. The Velveteen Rabbit. Most of you probably have heard of that. If you have children, most probably undoubtedly you have. But it was written almost 100 years ago. And a good first edition of that will cost you about $22,000. But it contains a message that, as the commercial says, is priceless. It's a story about self-worth, being worthy of being loved. It's about friendship. And I watched all the three Toy Story movies with my kids and loved them all. They tap into something that we never quite escape. It's the fantasy of toys coming to life. There's a little toy dog or a stuffed dog back here in the back row, Diamond Girl, and I'm sure, you know, we attach special significance to those little stuffed animals, deservedly so. But it's this common thing that we see through a lot of movies for children and for adults. It's about our desire for the perfect friendship. The story itself begins, I'll rehash with you a bit, begins with a young boy receiving a stuffed rabbit, or maybe it was a puppy, but it was a rabbit, as a gift. And as the story unfolds, we find it is a sad, self-conscious, rather ugly rabbit. It's filled with sawdust and insecurities. It's shunned, it's made fun of by the other pets, the other stuffed animals or toys. He's bullied by them. The more high-tech toys make fun of him. And outside, it even gets worse. Because the real rabbits, they see him as a fake. They see him as a fraud. They jeer that he's can't even hop. He doesn't have hind legs. He's not real. Well, as a result of having been in the nursery the longest, the skin horse kind of takes him under his wing. He has suffered the most wear and tear, but as his fur has worn off, you might remember, something striking has gradually happened to him. He has become real. He befriends this little rabbit, and he asks him. The rabbit asks him, "What is real?" He's envious of these more high-tech toys. He says, "Is it having something that buzzes inside you, like toys 100 years ago would have had, the high-tech toys? Does it mean that you're going to have a stick-out handle?" And the skin horse answers him, "Real isn't how you are made. It's a thing that happens to you. When a child plays with you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real." There was a Harvard study done. It was known as the Grant Study. It's the longest running study on human development. And it followed 268 graduates from the classes of 1938 to 1940. It was a 75-year study. And its purpose was to find out what makes us happy. The findings were in a recent book, Triumphs of Experience. Anyway, the study found that our happiness and our health, not surprisingly, they don't have much to do with how much money we make, how hard we work, how famous we become. Among their conclusions, the most important ingredient for meaning and happiness is loving relationships. Now, that doesn't come as a shock either, I don't believe. But certainly we yearn for that. The study says, just as important to your health as diet and exercise, smoking, and alcohol is friendship. Friendship matters. We were hiking some time ago with my children, as we do quite often, and I asked them about this. I was getting ready to speak about it in a couple weeks. I said, "What's the most important trait that you would like to see in a friend, that you want in a friend?" And my middle son, Caleb, he's getting ready to go back to medical school, and he said, "Trust." Or that was Nathaniel, actually, but Caleb was getting ready to go back to medical school during this time. Nathaniel, my oldest son who's here, I'm blessed to have part of my family here this morning, my wife, Deborah, and Natalie. Natalie's in pre-med herself, struggling. No, she's working hard. It's a struggle, believe you me, no matter how smart you are. Caleb said, my middle son said, wanting what is best for you in the long run. That's what he wants his friends to be like. Morgan, my youngest son, who's at ABC now, said unconditional love, and Natalie said loyalty. They weren't even close. No, I'm kidding. just seeing if you're awake. But all are intertwined in the message I'm going to give today, which is about friendship. It can sound trite, and I'll try not to make it that, but I give this message not because I'm particularly good or great at maintaining relationships, but it's something that I know I want to get better at. I want to become, you know, a better friend to people and have more friends that are close. It wasn't long ago that we were in a wedding. It was a neighbor. Some people used to be a neighbor of ours. They moved. And the neighbors who moved in behind them have really made us appreciate them. But we're at this wedding, and I talked to the father. If only you knew. I talked to the father a couple times, and I realized how much we had in common in a couple of short conversations. And I had missed a great opportunity. Now, we would talk with each other periodically as we're mowing lawns or doing things outside, but I didn't make an incredible effort. I wish I had. Aristotle saw friendship as the highest relationship there is, greater than those of blood or stimulated by physical attraction, which is quite a heavy bar. Now, I say, I agree with that. I don't agree with that, of course, honey. But David knew that, and he wrote a song. When he wrote a song to eulogize his best friend, Jonathan, the whole nation was meant to sing that song. He was lamenting. It was after Jonathan died, the loss of the best friend he'd ever had. And he concluded this, "Your love to me was more wonderful than that, the love of a woman." In many ways, we know his relationship with Saul was a model for friendship. There's some things, again, we've heard these things, and we'll try to bring things a little bit different, perhaps, maybe not. But the story of Jonathan is very lengthy. It stretches out over 40 chapters, starting in 1 Samuel 13. He's from a wealthy background, as you know. He's the king's son. He's the oldest of five siblings, three boys and two girls, and he's going to be the next king. In our first encounter with him, he is leading a third of the nation's army to a resounding victory over the Philistines. We learn almost immediately that Jonathan is a highly skilled warrior. And in chapter 14 of 1 Samuel, in verse 1, and I'll kind of go through these things. It's a story, it's a narrative, and you can turn, you don't have to. But the troops are deserting his dad and what was left of the army. Now, this is after he's had this incredible victory. And basically the army now is weaponless, and they're pretty hapless, and they're not really doing much, and they're scared, and they're hiding. And Jonathan begins to get ready to go up against this Philistine garrison. He's going to do something, but he only tells his armor bearer. He doesn't tell anybody else. We'll talk about the significance of an armor bearer. And he confides in him. He doesn't tell his dad. He says in verse 3 through 6 of 1 Samuel 14, he says, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that God will work for us, for nothing restrains God from saying or saving by many or by a few." So it's really somewhat of a spy mission. They skirt out around behind them in verse 8. And the Philistines, sensing something's happening, they turn around and they see him. And Jonathan has kind of figured out a way of seeing whether God's going to be with him. He looks for a sign, and sure enough, they give the sign. They start coming down the mountain towards him. And so it's pretty much, okay, they're going to make fun of us. They're saying, you know, they're hiding in their holes. Maybe they're coming out to surrender. They call to Jonathan and they say, "Come up to us and we'll show you something." Yeah, we're going to cut your throat. We're going to kill you. So it's this kamikaze type attitude that Jonathan has, this mission that he almost spontaneously undertakes. You see something of his character. So to his armor bearer, he says, come with me. "For the Lord has delivered them to our hand," to the hand of Israel. So they climb up this rock face. He faces down this Philistine garrison. Incredible courage. And he kills 20 of them and sets the rest of them off in a panic. Well, who does that sound like? Sounds like Saul, or it sounds like David, doesn't it? This young man confronting Goliath. He's confident, he's cocky, but even more than that, he's faithful, just like Jonathan. He says to Goliath, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin." This is in 1 Samuel 17. "But I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will hand you over to me." He says, "You're going to die. The carcass is going to eat your body. And God's going to give you to me. I don't want to cut your head off. You're dead." And then they meet. It's right after this that they meet for the first time. And I'm going to talk about some of the things that they bring out What is friendship? Well, number one, true friendship is a gift. True friendship is a gift from God. During one of our many hikes to, this time to Waterfall, we were starting back to the car, and Deborah and I wanted to get a head start on our kids. They're a little bit more nimble than we are, and have a little more endurance. But anyway, as we're going up, we'd stop, you know, to look around and really to rest, but to look around at them and just to see our kids. You know, you're proud of your kids. And they're down there in the sun. They've been swimming in pretty cold water. And we just watch them. And we realize that our friends, our children have become friends. It's a neat, wonderful gift. There's always been some conflict in my family. And it's something to take great joy and pleasure in, to see your kids having fun, enjoying each other's company. In 1 Samuel 17, in the last four verses, it recounts David and Jonathan meeting. And I won't go into great detail because you know it. We've been there many times. But he meets the king's son, and it appears to be friendship at first sight. People say, that can't happen. It's incredibly instant in its nature, to the degree things can be instant. In the next chapter, chapter 18, verse 1, it says the soul, this is mental, this is physical, of Jonathan was knit. This means they're bound together with the soul of David. Mentally, physically, in the ways that we can be united at such a quick time. This is what happened. Lang's commentary notes the word knit. It means a steel chain. These links together that are indissoluble bonds. The name Jonathan means God has given, or given by God. It's almost as though Jonathan was made for David and David was made for Jonathan, more accurately. David, of course, means beloved. So this friendship suggests a gift from God, something supernatural. I think friendships are supernatural. Verse 3, then Jonathan made a covenant, the first covenant, with David. There will be three, because he loved him as his own soul. In Proverbs 18, David's son, 18 verse 24, David's own son wrote this, there's a friend that sticks closer than a brother, closer than blood. And David is going to come to understand the worth of this friend as times get really dark. At this moment, he has no idea how dark things are going to get. He doesn't have a hint. At this time, he doesn't realize how bad things are going to get. Some have suggested that as far as gifts from God go, only salvation exceeds friendship. Now, it's a neat idea. I'm not saying I would say that. I've not looked at it closely enough, but we look to the church, don't we, to kind of knit us together. It's one of the reasons we're here. It's the reason I like to come here, to see old friends and hopefully make new ones. Number two, true friendship is exceptional. It's unusual. It's rare. It's unusual. It's exceptional. It's rare. There was a guy named Coy Wells who used to be the door greeter in Kingsport. I love that man and had known him for many years. And he loved to greet me this way. He'd say, it's easy to keep up with your friends when you have so few. And I always felt that was a little bit of a put-down. But I've come to appreciate, I liked Coy. I could take his bantering. When Deborah taught in the first grade, she was a first grade teacher for a number of years. The teachers, I think she was at a seminar, I don't know if I'll get this right this time, but they were told that when kids are friends in first grade, don't separate them. I mean, unless they become catastrophic and it becomes chaotic because of them. Because this might be the only close friend they ever have. That shows you how rare it is. There's a writer, Dave Barry, who I really like. And a friend of mine a couple weeks ago sent me, and I just read it last night for the first time, a Wall Street Journal article about his dog. He said he found out his dog and him were both turning 70. 70 in dog years and him actually 70. And he says, he talks about when he does public events. If you know Dave Barry, read his writing. He's very funny. He's just a real comic. He's written a lot of books. He's an editorial writer down in Florida. But he says, believe you me, I am shy. But he goes to all these book signings. He's got Mr. Personality on the outside. He said, I'm shy. The result is that at age 70, I know a ton of people. But I have few close friends, mostly people I met long ago. And the truth is, I hardly ever see or talk to them. He said, for all I know, some of my closest friends could be dead. The only way to find out would be for me to call them and talk to them about what's going on in their lives. And I never do that. He said his wife has a ton of friends, all of which are closer to her than any of his friends are to him. Well, this is not statistically abnormal. Stats tell us that most people are lucky if they have one close friend in their lifetime. I found that startling. If you're a white male, which there's quite a few out here, you are in fact very lucky if you have a good close friend. There was a 2006 analysis. They followed people for two decades, or they looked at data from two decades. And they found that adult white men have the fewest friends of all people in America. And we could blame the media. That's probably their fault. We'll just blame the media. David is an exception to this rule. It says in 1 Kings 5, verse 1, it just alluded to that, that King Hiram of Tyre had always loved Solomon's father, David. Somebody on even keel with it. It wasn't just that David was king or David was the leader of the army. This was a guy who could make friends. He had the capacity to inspire loyalty and friendship. The relationship, though, that he had with Jonathan, from what we can tell, was still unique and exceptional. You know, they had three different contracts with each other, which gives you the idea that there were a lot of obligations that they had that set up between them. But their main obligation was to each other. C.S. Lewis said of friendship, it is born at the moment when one man says to another, "What? You too? I thought that no one but myself," and then you can fill in the blank. And it can be so trivial, that first little connection that you form. You know, it's in intense times. It can be college. It can be while you're sick. It can be during the trials of life. It can be sports. It can be any number of things that will forge these friendships or make them more likely. There's a lot of famous generals and admirals, but very few famous military friendships. One I want to allude to here, hopefully it'll be briefly, Longstreet, General James Longstreet and General U.S. Clark, Ulysses S. Clark. It's so remarkable because these two guys were introverts, and they meet at West Point. And Longstreet's over 6 feet tall. Grant at the time was 5'1". Entirely different backgrounds. They had nothing in common except they both loved horses more than people. And fighting on the outside, both they fought on opposite sides of the war. Grant becomes only the second man after George Washington to be raised to the rank of lieutenant general. And then, of course, Longstreet was a Confederate. He rose to the level of general under Robert E. Lee, one of his most trusted confidants. So upon his death, Longstreet would say of Grant, "He was the truest as well as the bravest man that ever lived." He told a reporter from the New York Times the very next day, "Ever since 1839, this is when they met at West Point, I have been on terms of the closest intimacy with Grant." It all started, they liked horses. I will remember the fragile form which answered to the name that year. His distinguishing trait as a cadet was a girlish modesty, a hesitancy in presenting his own claims. The general leading the Union forces. As I was of large and robust physique, I was accomplished at almost most larks and games. But in these, young Grant never joined because of his delicate frame. But in horsemanship, he was noted as the most proficient in the academy, and that drew Longstreet to him. The friendship formed had never been broken and started so trivially, but theirs was a charm which held together, he said. This is him writing. He said, the friendship formed, I should read it as a quote from him, had never been broken, but there was a charm which held us together of which the world has never heard. That's how impressive, he thought, this friendship that started so trivially, it seems, was. David, as we noted, would never have a friend like Jonathan, and the same was true from what we can tell of Jonathan. Number three, true friends want what's best for you. Now, in the case of Jonathan and David, they extended that to include their families. And that's a pretty hard family when you realize that Jonathan's dad was Saul. But from the very beginning, Jonathan felt towards David this unselfish nature. And that never ended. You know, back in 1 Samuel 18, verse 4, when it said that David loved him as his own soul, let's look at what he did right after that. Right after he said, I loved him as my own soul. I mean, he just met him. And he's saying, I loved him as my own soul. In verse 4 it says, and Jonathan stripped himself of the robes that were upon him and gave it to David, of the robe, and his armor, and even his sword, and his bow, and his girdle. Every sign of status, every sign of rank and honor, things that would cause you to recognize him, things that would protect him, perhaps even more importantly, here's this prince basically saying, it's all yours. He gave it to David. His dad would later warn him and say, listen, as long as the son of Jesse, couldn't even bring himself to say David's name, is alive, you will never be king. One of the hardest things for humans is the proper use of power. And even harder to use power is to give it up. And perhaps the most beautiful Old Testament example of somebody giving up power, yielding the throne, is Jonathan to David. But he did it. It was an incredible risk. It wasn't that he just gave up his power and he went home. He did this at incredible risk. And I want to share with you what happened when Saul sensed that somebody was disloyal to him. If you gave the least little hint you were disloyal to Saul, it was ugly. In 1 Samuel 22, verse 1, David is again in a cave. He found himself in caves, you know, frequently, and alluded to by Steve here earlier. And so it says that when they found out that's where he was, all of his father's house heard it, and they followed him. And let me give you a description of that ragtag group that followed him, including his parents, which he took care to make sure they were safe. Verse 2, and everyone that was in distress, and everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented, how would you like to have those people befriending you? Distressed, discontent, even worse than that, in debt. And they all gathered around him, it says. And they became, and he became a captain over them. It was an army of about 400 men. And Saul, meanwhile, becomes incensed that nobody told him. How dare them? He suspects that his own son is plotting with David to kill him. Now, it's right after this that Saul learns where David has been. And David has been, you might recall, to the tabernacle at Nob. He went there by himself. This is before he went to the cave, before he had these 400 men. He's by himself. And he goes to the tabernacle because he's hungry and he really realizes he needs protection. He needs a weapon. He doesn't have a weapon at this time with him. And so he goes to this tabernacle and the high priest is Ahimelech. And so Ahimelech gives him bread and gives him a sword. And I'll say that sword is an incredible sword, which I will talk about. If I ever come back up again, I'll talk about that sword. It's pretty incredible. All of this he sees witnessed by Doeg. D-O-E-G, Doeg. And Doeg tells Saul. And Saul sends for Ahimelech. He says, okay, you can help David. I want to see Ahimelech. Now, all these people could have joined David. They chose not to. And he pretty much tries him right there in his court of his opinion. And he doesn't just send for Ahimelech. He sends for all the priests from Nob. There's 84 of them, both young and old. Trainees and the ones who've been around, the veterans. And he orders his bodyguards to kill these 85 men, all of them. Now, Saul's bodyguards are incredible warriors, but they know what it is to cross Saul. But it's pretty amazing. They refuse. And Saul has enough confidence and faith and love for these guys that he doesn't put them to death immediately, but he turns to Doeg. This proven liar. Now, Doeg heard David say to Saul, David say to Ahimelech. See, Ahimelech, he knows, is afraid. He realizes David's mere presence there brings him into some real danger. And so he tells Ahimelech, essentially, and this is Doeg is listening from what we can tell. He says, look, I'm here on secret business of the king. You know, the king was Saul. He goes, I'm here, you know, don't worry, because I'm here. The king wants me to come here. I'm on secret business, passing through. Doeg hears all this, but you know, he never tells this part to Saul. We don't know how much difference it would have made, but it does raise an issue of question of whether he was truly disloyal. And so he has him kill Ahimelech of the 84 priests, And then he does something even more than that. He goes to the tabernacle at Nob, and guess who he kills? He kills anyone related to Ahimelech. He kills his sons, he kills all the children, he kills the men and the women and the babies. It says those that were nursing. He kills them all. Saul, paranoid and filled with hate, can't stand the thought of somebody being disloyal to even the nth degree. But you know, something happens. There's one priest that escapes. It's the son of Ahimelech, Abiathar. I think it's Abiathar, I guess. And he says to him, David is sad, he's guilty, he realizes he has caused havoc to be wreaked on Abiathar's family. He says, I have caused the death, this is chapter 20, 1 Samuel, verse 31. I have caused the death of all in your father's house. Stay with me, and I'll keep you safe. He realizes there's a commitment he's going to make to this guy because of what he did to this extended family. And Abiathar will go on to become, here's quite an interesting story, a high priest, the next high priest. Friends, William Bennett writes in the Book of Virtues, I bought that one time when I just thought of it, came out when I was in Roanoke, years ago, when my brother-in-law David Stone was here as a minister. Friends, William Bennett writes in that book, should be allies of our better nature. Our better nature. The better nature is the part that involves God, a relationship with God. You know, Job wanted that kind of a relationship. He wanted a relationship with somebody who would bring him closer to God. It says in Job 19, verse 19, all of my close friends abhor. They detest me. Now, what would it be like to have all your close friends detesting you? That word, C-O-W-D-H, it's a word that means God's presence with him. In other words, having that friend is the same as having God close to you. Not the same, but it's similar to having God close to you, God's presence there. It's used to describe an intimate relationship of God visiting his tent, as they say. Isn't it neat when friends, when you have conversations with people, and you realize when it's over that you feel closer to God? James, in James 3, verse 16, warns. He says, he calls it the wisdom from above. And he says, he calls it selfish ambition when you don't share that. If you learn something and you know something and you don't share it with people in a conversation, that's selfish ambition. The proverb, iron sharpens iron, so a friend sharpens a friend. It's about conversation. It's about the conversations that direct us to the transcendent, to a more intimate relationship with God. So, we follow on down what's happening in David's life. David again finds himself with a ragtag army. They're afraid of the Philistines. They're really quaking, you know? And Saul has never quit pursuing David. It says he pursued him every day, hunted him every day. And he's so busy hunting them, he never gets the Philistines under control. Kind of like ISIS, you know, for a long time, they just wreaked havoc. David, or Saul, because he was so obsessed with David, never got them under control. And he would pay dearly. His family would pay dearly for the fact that he was distracted so much of his life with getting David. So David, in the midst of fleeing, he comes to this city called Keilah. And the Philistines essentially control this town, Keilah. I guess K-E-I-L-A-H, Keilah. And the Philistines control it. They've taken advantage of Saul's distraction once again. But first, before David does this, he realizes, my army is just scared to death. He says in verse 2 of 1 Samuel 23, should we attack? And God says, yeah, attack. I'll deliver them. Save Keilah. They needed saving. In verse 3, his men are afraid. So he goes to God again. And he says, can I win? Can I take over the city? He still has these questions. And God says, go and you will win. And it's over his objections, the objections of this army that he goes ahead and fights. And it says in verse 5, he saved the people of Keilah. Now you'd think they would be welcoming David, you know, because David, after all, is a guy that people followed, right? And so after this happens, Saul, you know, there's intelligence going all over the place, and Saul finds out where David is. He thinks, oh, he's holed up in that city. Well, cities don't just keep people out, they keep people in. And he says, God has delivered him to me. Well, David also knows where Saul is and what's happening in Saul's camp. So he realizes, I got to get out of here. But first he says, I wonder if these people would give me up. If I were to stay and fight, what would happen? So he goes to God, as he did so often, and he asks God for wisdom to do what's right. And he says, will Saul come after me? First of all, that's important. And God says, yeah, he will. And so he says in verse 12, will the citizens of Keilah surrender me? And God says, oh, yeah, they'll surrender you. And he said, well, what about my men? You know, will they surrender my men? Because he's thinking, this army just vanquished the Philistines. And God says, they will. And so he realizes he has no choice. He flees, it says, to the mountains. At this time, he has 600 men, none of which seem to be too brave. So he's in the woods, and Saul is searching for him. You would think that you could follow a band of 600 people and figure out where they were. But that's how tortuous a type of place they were in. Saul couldn't find him. But guess who finds him? Jonathan finds him. His best friend finds him at this incredibly dark hour. And in 1 Samuel 23, verse 16, it says, when Jonathan met him in the woods, what was his priority? What was his purpose? Was he going to talk about football? That's what I was telling Steve on the way down. I said, this writer I was telling you about earlier was saying that Dave Barry said that he thinks sports are simply an excuse for men to talk about nothing meaningless, to talk about nothing that really matters. So he's probably got a point. But anyway, so when he meets him in the woods, what does he do? His priority is he strengthened his hand in God. It's an Old Testament expression. It means to encourage, especially those who are afraid. He did what a friend is supposed to do. He directed him to God. In verse 17, it talks about the reassurance of Jonathan. It says, don't be afraid. And then he reminds them of one of their agreements. It's neat to go through their agreements, but of one of this prior promise. He says, you will be king. Think, well, you can't die because you're going to be king. You've been anointed. And he says, my dad will never find you. That's an incredible, you know, a guy who he loved his dad, was conflicted. As we'll see, he loved his dad. My dad will never find you, and I will be second to you. I'll be second in rank, and I'm okay with that. David, for all his consulting of God, he talked to God, just back and forth. You know, what should I do? Needed what? He needed physical contact. He needed a friend. He needed somebody, a human presence. Oliver Cromwell, a great fighter himself, wrote, he called it one beam of light in a dark place. He said, that has such exceedingly great refreshment in it. The first time I read that, I was down at Wake Forest, and my wife was with me. I don't know if I was in the hospital then or what, but I read that and thought, oh, isn't that neat to have a friend, this beam of light when you're in a dark place. David's son wrote in the Proverbs 27, verse 6, about, it's the same chapter as iron sharpens iron. He said, faithful are the wounds of a friend. Now, sometimes friends bring us closer to God, not by agreeing with everything we do, right? They strengthen our hand in God by showing us where we're wrong. If they truly love us, what a friendship that is, to have somebody who can tell you you're wrong and you don't, it doesn't change your relationship. It may deepen it, or it should. In 1 Samuel 28 or 23, verse 18, is their third covenant. I guess I alluded to that. But it says, David will be king, and I'm going to rejoice. His best friend says, even though it's supposed to be mine, he doesn't say that, but that's inferred. Hey, I'm happy for you. This would be the last time they will ever meet. And it ends on it's one of those neat endings to what's up to then an incredible friendship. The next time we will talk about Jonathan, I think, I'm not sure if this is the next time, but he is fighting alongside his dad and his brothers. And who is he fighting against? The Philistines. They're going to kill all of them. The Philistines are going to kill them. And so all of this preoccupation with something. Well, with much of Saul's house destroyed, it says, what's on David's mind? He's a king, it's years later, and something flashes through his mind. This is in 2 Samuel 9. And he says this, is there still anyone who is left of the house of Saul? I realize this timer up here doesn't do anything. I'm thinking it was, okay, a totally different time than it is. But at any rate, he says, is there anyone who is left in the house of Saul that I may show him kindness? Why would he want to show him kindness to this family of Saul? And he says, for Jonathan's sake. In verse 3, he doesn't take credit for it, he calls it the kindness of God. He said, it's the kindness of God that I'm expressing by looking to not just Jonathan, my good friend, but to look after his family. So who's left? It's his son. Jonathan has a son who's crippled, you might recall. I'm not going to, Mephibosheth or something, I didn't write it down, but Seth. Or, anyway, it's his son, and he survived, and David finds out. By now, he's an adult, and he finds out who he is, and he cares for him. And so Jonathan, David said to him, I don't have time for the whole conversation, pretty neat, but he says, do not fear, because, you know, hey, look, if you're a relative of Saul, you'd think you should fear when you come up to him, David. For I will surely show you kindness for Jonathan, your father's sake. Will restore you to all the land of Saul, your grandfather. Which David could have had. And you shall eat bread at my table continually. I'm going to take care of you till you die. You have nothing to worry about. You know, it's really neat to realize, or sad, I guess is a better way of saying it, that Saul started out loving David. Legitimately loving David. And it's not hard to see why. And really, in a way, it was love at first sight. He liked him immediately. In 1 Samuel 16, verse 18, Saul is looking for somebody to sing to. He's not looking for an armor bearer. He wants somebody who can play music, who can calm, maybe not sing to him, but calm his restless soul, as it says. And so one of the servants there says, hey, there's somebody I know who's got a rather impressive resume. I want to tell you about him. And this is where he tells him, he said, he's a talented harp player. That's really, it should be enough, right? But then he goes on. He's a mighty man of valor. He's brave. He's a warrior. He's eloquent. He's handsome. And above all, the Lord is with him. You can see how Jonathan loved him immediately. And in fact, when Saul heard this, he could, in some ways, have been describing his own son. In verse 21, he said, he loved him greatly. Just immediately he loved him greatly. And what does he do? And he made him his armor bearer. Well, if you have any idea, when Jonathan was going up that mountain with his armor bearer, there's an incredible amount of risk for that armor bearer. And there's an incredible amount of risk for you if you don't have a good one, because you put your life in the hands of that armor bearer. He has to be brave, he has to be loyal, he has to be strong, he has to be able. He's going to carry extra weapons, and you know what he's going to do? Everybody that you wound, he's going to kill. And so as Jonathan is slashing through these people, or as Saul slashed through these people, he wounded a lot of them. It's pretty crude weaponry. And so the armor bearer had an incredibly tough job that taxed him and that tested his moral fiber, for that matter, and his physical strength. Well, what an incredible gift David was for Saul. And Saul knew it immediately, and then he forgot. He let pride and envy and jealousy, things that prohibit a good friendship, come between him. Imagine how if Saul would have liked David at all, it would have changed the entire trajectory of his life. And so time went on, and the little rabbit was very happy. So happy that he never noticed how his beautiful velveteen fur was getting shabbier and shabbier, and his tail becoming unsewn. And all the pink rubbed off his nose, for the boy had kissed him. So he asked the skin horse about becoming real, becoming someone who matters. He said, first of all, he's worried, does it hurt? Sometimes, said the skin horse, for he was always truthful, when you are real, you don't mind being hurt. He says, does it happen all at once or bit by bit? No, it doesn't happen all at once, said the skin horse. You become. It takes a long time. That's why it doesn't happen to people who break easily or have sharp edges or have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off. And your eyes drop out and you get loose in the joints and you're very shabby. But those things don't matter at all, because once you are real, you can be ugly, except to the people who don't understand. Or you can't be ugly. He said, you can only be ugly to those who don't understand. True friendship is a gift. It's a rare gift. It should make us better than we otherwise would be. As my children reminded me, it requires trust, wanting what is best for the other person in the long run, unconditional love, and loyalty. And as we've seen, a lot more. The writer F.W. Borm, who I'll probably quote every time I come up here, he said, I would gladly associate myself with any institution in the world that would help me keep my friendship in repair. Life, he said, knows no wealthier enrichment than the enrichment represented by the linking of other lives with our own. And so, we come to church.